Hello, my name is Janet, and it's Monday, June 8th, and I will be reading from Boston Magazine, the June 2026 edition. Okay. Real Talk with Rosie. The Real Housewives of Rhode Island star on Becoming Nosy Rosie, why she cried more during filming than she has in years, and whether the accent on the show is actually legit, by Jonathan Soroff. Before Rosie DeMere was a Real Housewife of Rhode Island, she was a hard-nosed reporter, which is to say she had been asking people uncomfortable questions for a living for some time now. These days, she asks them of her castmates, which is roughly how she ended up known as Nosy Rosie. Poking, prodding, and saying what nobody wants said is, as she puts it, just kind of my nature. Whether that makes her the troublemaker or just the one paying attention is up for debate. She grew up in Massachusetts, went to Boston University, and interned at KISS 108, where she also met her husband, Rich. With The Real Housewives of Rhode Island's finale this month, we talked to her about Dell's lemonade, lip filler, and hopefully becoming best friends with Andy Cohen. 5 years ago, you were a Providence News anchor waking up at 2 a.m. What would you have said if I told you you'd be on Real Housewives? I would have thought you were a crazy person. Not only that, I'd be like, what do you mean? I'm in a news contract. There's no way I'm going to be on a show like that. Keep in mind that 5 years ago, I was living in my apartment in Providence. I was single, and I was getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to go to work every day on the news. In my mind, as a 30-year-old, I had totally made it. I was paying all my bills by myself, and I had bought myself a condo. I was driving my dream car, which was my Jeep Wrangler, and I was going out in Boston with my friends from BU, doing stuff in Providence, doing the news. I was one of the main faces of number one station in Rhode Island. How could I get any better than that? So I definitely didn't see this coming. Were you a Housewife fan before this? I was a Kathy Hilton fan. So I would watch Real Housewives of Beverly Hills a little bit here and there. I just think she's so funny. But I was getting up in the middle of the night for most of my career, going to work at 3 a.m., and I wasn't able to tune in at 8 or 9. I was not a fan, but I wasn't an avid viewer. Did your years as a hard-nosed reporter change the way you operated on the show? 1,000,000%. You also have to remember that I'm 35, I've been out of the news for 2 to 5 years, but I've spent all my 20s as a hard news reporter. I didn't start doing traffic or lifestyle until I was 30. Before that, I was going to crime scenes, interviewing politicians, asking hard questions, noticing inconsistencies, saying, that doesn't make sense. Explain this to me. I'd be very blunt. I am very blunt. I'm also very logical and a bit too literal sometimes. Rich makes fun of me for that. But when you're used to asking important politicians who are 60 years old very comfortable questions, sitting down with a group of girls is not uncomfortable. Did you go in with a plan? No. I wish I had. I didn't realize that I needed to do that, which is very naive. I thought you just go on the show and you just be yourself and everyone will like you and everyone will get to know you and everyone will want to hear what you have to say and you'll all just be friends. By the episode 4 or 5, I learned that was not the case. And I know other people went into that with a plan or with a pact of whatever. Next year, maybe I'll go in with a plan. How real is really? I don't think it's very real. Do producers push the drama, or do you all do that on your own? I don't think they encourage anything. It's just, this is a show, and they're watching your real life, and you know, we need drama for it to make sense. Who was the peacekeeper? I think Alicia Carmody was trying her best to be neutral, but I don't necessarily know if there's anyone who was a peacekeeper. Who was the shit stirrer? They'll tell you it was me, and I agree that sometimes it was, because I would ask questions they didn't want to ask or point out things that they didn't want to be pointed out. I wasn't ever going to be malicious, but it's just kind of in my nature. But I think as the show goes on, you'll see who actually is just out there causing problems for no reason. You'll see. So, do you deny being the bad guy? Maybe I am the villain. Maybe I really am. Who knows? Worst part of having cameras on you 24/7. I actually didn't mind the cameras. I didn't always want the girls around, but I had no problem with the cameras. Anything you'd do differently? I really just tried to be myself, and I think my only regret is that I should have fought back a lot sooner than I did. I'm not proud of the fact that I cried a lot. I would come home, and Rich would say, "We've been together for 5 years, and I've never seen you cry like that once. And this summer, you've cried every day." It's very overwhelming, and I was just trying to understand what was going on a lot of the time. I would say things or point things out or ask questions, and then I'd get up and beat up for it. And instead of what I would normally do, which is to fight back a little harder, I would kind of back down. So I would say my biggest regret was being a little soft. What has gotten the show right about you, and what has it missed? I do hope people get to know me more. I think what you see in episode 5 of me talking about how much I love gay men and how silly I am being with my dog, Clemmy, in the confessionals. I say, don't look at her cooch or whatever, which is crazy. Why did I say that? But that stuff really does represent of who I am. People don't really know about my personal life or my marriage. They don't know really what I do for work other than what's been made fun of on the show so far. I think there's a lot still to come. As for showing that I have a little bit of messy side and the kind of clock everything that's going to pretty quickly and will blurt out what is not supposed to be said, that's also true. I'm someone somewhat social awkward. I don't always understand what's going on in the group dynamics. There's not a favorite qualities about me, but they're real. Favorite memory from doing the show. On episode 6 or 7, Ashley and I had the most fun on the water slide. It was the best time. I also loved another scene with Alicia and Alicia's daughter in my Jeep. I had fun with the bouncy shoes. I tried my best to show that I'm just a silly girl who loves the Disney Channel and doesn't take life too seriously. I'm so lucky to have Ashley and Ashley as real-life close friends. I would never have met Rula without this experience, and now we're becoming good, really good friends. Even after all the drama, whatever, a lot of it has been really fun. Why do you think the Real Housewives is so popular? You know, I see these memes and reels, and there's something about seeing other people fight and have total chaos that somehow calms the nervous system as a viewer. It doesn't calm my nervous system, but I think it calms theirs. Your favorite thing about Rhode Island? Probably the food, which is such a crazy thing to say. But Rhode Island has such good food, and I feel like the food scene isn't appreciated enough. Coffee, milk, stuffies, Dell, which of these are you actually eating? Gotta love the Dell's lemonade. The production staff was so obsessed with it all summer, which I found so odd. Every day after work, they had to get their Dell's lemonade. I was like, all right, sure, I don't really do coffee milk, but I love a pizza strip or a party pizza. It's so funny, too, because I grew up in Massachusetts, right near the Rhode Island border, and yet I didn't learn of these things until I was living here. Where are you eating when you're not trying to impress anyone? There are so many good spots, but right near our house, there's a place called Safe House in East Greenwich. It's not the fanciest restaurant, but it's probably my favorite because it's close, like 5 minutes away. But I tell you, they have some of the best chicken parm and the best drinks. The accents on the show are operatic. Anyone laying it on? No, I think that's really how they all talk. Alicia's getting heat for her accent or things she says. I can tell you with 100% certainty, she is 100% being herself, and she really does talk that way, and she does act that way. As one of her close friends, I get voice memos on a daily basis that are so funny. If I put them on the internet, they'd get a million views and a million likes. We're dealing with someone who's actually hysterical and can't help it. Rhode Island is the smallest state, but has the most regional accents. Explain. It's like a small little town, though. Everyone knows each other, but there are different sectors, and they all talk a certain way. Johnston, North Providence, Cranston, Newport, South County, but overall, I think Rhode Island's accent is a mix between Boston and New York. I've said that since I started reporting here. Then there's the added cultural thing with a big Italian and Portuguese dynamic. And then there are people like me who have no accent because I had to go to speech school for journalism. Walk me through your beauty regime. My routine is so extravagant. My whole thing is that I do a lot, so I'm low maintenance in everyday life. I get Botox, I get lasers, I get facials, I get hair extensions, I get lip filler. I get all the things so even though I have to do all these things on different days, I actually wake up looking pretty, and that's kind of my secret. Does your husband Rich, who's also a performer, sing to you? He never sings to me, honestly. He sings to the dog more than he sings to me. But one of the things I love about Rich is that we'll have sing-alongs in the car, and instead of just being me, being a weirdo, singing at the top of my lungs, he does it too. Or we'll go to karaoke, and I make him sing all the boy parts from something like Beauty and the Beast. I'm Belle, and he has to sing the Beast part. But I don't need him to sing to me on a daily basis. That would be weird. Things you're proudest of. Being married to Rich, being a good dog mom. I'm very proud of the house we're building and the fact we're doing it ourselves. I'm proud of myself for my television career that I had for more than 10 years and how I've worked hard to get where I am. What the show actually opened up for you? I really don't know. Even though the girls make fun of my little TV show, I'm very happy with my little TV show, Road Trippin'. It's on ABC6 every Saturday at 6:30. I have a decent audience, and I get to help some local businesses. Now it's becoming a few national businesses, too. I get to give them a shout-out or do commercial work for them. I don't think I ever want to go back being on the news or doing something that full-time. I like being able to just do my thing. How has it changed for you? I'm very happy with my life. I was happy with the way my life was before. I'm ecstatic to be able to do more DJing. I'm doing WeHo Pride, which will never happen if it weren't for the publicity. I'm a big ally to the gay community, and I love that. And big ally, excuse me. So it's exciting to have more opportunities, but if I'm honest, I'm very happy with the way things are. Who did you get compared to? I've been getting a lot of Katy Perry, Megan Fox mixtures online. Like, kind of looks like if they had a baby, which I don't hate at all. It's very nice. I've been compared to Whitney Rose a lot. I don't really understand the comparison, but I'm here for it. That's fine. Tell me a secret about Andy Cohen. I don't really know Andy Cohen. He seems like a great guy. He went to BU like me, but not at the same time. I haven't spent that much time with him. I hope to make him my best friend. He has great hair. Foot traffic. Hoka and On open flagships on Newbury Street, just steps from the boutiques that built their Boston following by J.C. Conroy. Boston is already a sneaker city. We're home to New England, to New Balance, Reebok, Converse, not to mention the host of one of the most prestigious marathons. So when national performance brands Hoka and On recently unveiled their new storefronts on Newbury Street, just a stone throw from the smaller indie realtors that have already carried their shoes, it raises few eyebrows. Does this city really need more sneakers? And perhaps more important, what happens to the big brand moves in next door to its own Stockets. For the footwear companies, the strategy is largely win-win. Opening their own stores, according to Nyla, O-R-D-A-B-A-Y-E-V-A, a marketing professor at Boston University, Kostrom School of Business, allows them to shape everything from merchandising to pricing to the overall customer experience without competing for attention alongside the other labels. Hoka's brand ships, for instance, are designed to serve as a beacon for the Hoka experience, says Nick Mancini, the company's senior director of the Retail of North America, bringing its performance focus and community-driven approach to life. On the upscale shopping street like Newbury, it's also about perception. A branded storefront signals a certain level of status, positioning sneakers as not just functional but also aspirational. Think of all the giant ads. Visibility in the physical store is one of the greatest ways to create awareness. On intentionally opening its hub store just days before the Boston Marathon, when hundreds of thousands of people were conveying onto the Back Bay, it was an incredible, meaningful milestone for us, Dan Shade, the brand's general manager of the Americas, said in a statement. For the independent realtors that helped build their brands locally, an impact is more a nuance. While there may be some short-term overlap in boutiques like Trend, which carries a wider selection of On sneakers at two locations, just steps from the brand-new storefront and the Marathon Sports, which carries both On and Hoka at its nearby Boylston Street location. Local realtor experts believe the effect should even out over time. Neither Trend nor Marathon Sports responded to the request for comment. After all, brand stores offer depth and fully immersive experience, while multi-brand realtors provide all important variety. We see it as a new positive, says Whitney Galvin, head of the retail leasing at Boston Realty Advisors, noting that brand stores help increase overall foot traffic and elevate the retail ecosystem on Newbury Street. And right now, the street is getting stronger, Galvin says, pointing to a low vacancy rates and an influx of new brands and surge in food and beverage concepts that have been driving consistent foot traffic. As more companies chase the demand, the line between partner and competitor may blur, but on Newbury, the overall effect is momentum. A ballad for little Mikey. Everyone knows the FBI protected Boston mobsters like Whitey Bulger, but no one knows about the 20-year-old kid who died because of it, or the father who lost everything trying to avenge him, by Michelle McPhee. Michael Romano doesn't look like a man who's been to war. He's 73 years old, beefily built, with dark hair and blue eyes that light up when he talks about his 13 grandchildren. On a recent afternoon, he walked towards a black Chevy Suburban parked outside the Long Wharf Marriott near the aquarium, wearing a Scully cap and a black Barracuda-style jacket. A cluster of tourists is waiting. Each of them paid $79 to climb into his SUV for what Romano has dubbed the original Boston mob tours. Unlike most tourist operations in Boston, Romano isn't reading from a script. He lived it. The Suburban pulls out. Romano talks over the recorded narration, adding his own color to the landmarks. At the Rose Kennedy Greenway, he pauses. "She is my hero," he says. "She spent all her husband's money helping women and children in South Boston." In South Boston, he stops in front of the Fox and the Knife, what used to be the Triple O's, the old hangout of James Whitey Bulger and his Winter Hill Gang. "If you go right, you get a good Irish meal," Romano tells the tourist. "If you go left, you go to the basement and come out in a bag." He points out Bulger's former home nearby, then former Senate President Billy Bulger's house a few doors down. Sometimes he says Billy's daughter comes outside during his tours. He doesn't care. It just fiddles with the gold chain around his neck. He has worn it every day since 1994. "It belonged to my son." On September 1st, 1994, Michael Romano Jr. jumped into a car on East Boston with two other men. He was 20 years old, a newlywed, a former high school hockey star, and a father of one with another on the way. His wife was waiting for him at their Winthrop home. Everyone called him Little Mikey. The driver that night was Enrico Ponzo, a member of the Patricia crime family who collected extortion money and sold cocaine, according to court records. Mikey's old man had called him a bad character, warning Mikey to keep his distance. In fact, weeks earlier, Mikey and Ponzo had been arrested on charges of possession of cocaine with intent to distribute, according to court documents. Ponzo eased the car into the parking lot off Revere Beach Parkway. He was there to shake down Joseph Serene, who managed a nearby stadium cafe, for an envelope of cash. According to the court documents, the men emerged from the bar a short time later and found one of the car tires had been slashed. Ponzo was spooked. He's been part of the botched hit on a rival mob boss 5 years earlier, and slashing a tire was a classic move to enable an ambush. He went back to the cafe and called for help with the flat. Little Mikey, on the other hand, was anxious to get home to his wife. He dropped to his knees and made quick work of changing the tire. Not quick enough. Moments later, a stolen van carrying three men screeched into the parking lot. One of them leaned out and fired a single shot at Mikey's face. The man later identified in court testimony as David Clark, Joseph Souza, and Stephen Rossetti, peeled out of the lot. Just over a mile away, they dumped and torched the van and got into another vehicle. Then, according to court testimony from someone with knowledge of the incident, they drove back to check out the scene with a camera. They saw they had killed the wrong guy. Ponzo was leaning against the car with the third man they had arrived with, talking to the cops. A few miles away, Mikey's father was on the boat dock at the marina in Eastie, watching the sun hit the steeple of Old North Church across the harbor, when his phone rang. It was Darlene, his wife, who had raised Mikey as her own since he was a kid, calling from their Wakefield house. She told him she had just gotten a frantic call from Mikey's wife, who said there had been an accident and Mikey was in the hospital. They agreed to meet at Mass General. Romano hung up and raced towards the summer tunnel towards Boston. When he arrived at the emergency room, crowded with cops, doctors told him Mikey was gone. Darlene collapsed to the floor, shrieking. Romano couldn't comprehend what they were telling him. All he could do was pound the wall, screaming, "No, no, no." That night, Romano tried to comfort his younger daughters, then drank himself into unconsciousness. Before dawn, Darlene shook him and brought him to the television. A state trooper had been shot on Route 3. The gunman was David Clark, a convicted murderer out on parole, who investigators would later determine appeared to have fled the murder scene in Everett hours earlier. In the back of his van, investigators found a gym band containing a gun, two ski masks, and a police badge. Clark was never convicted of first-degree murder for killing the trooper. Clark was later convicted of first-degree murder for killing the trooper. Romano didn't need anyone to connect the dots. The night his son was killed, Romano called Robert Lucy Jr., a man he'd grown up with in Easton and met with months earlier at a sit-down between the two Warren factions of the Patriotic crime family. For 2 years, the two sides have been killing each other over the control of the organization and its cocaine trade. On one side was the crew of Robert Bobby Russo Carosa, to which Romano was loyal. On the other side was Francis Cadillac Frank Slimmy, a longtime Whitey Bulger ally and a strong arm, including the cousins Mark and Stephen Rossetti. On a June morning in 1989, the two factions clashed with Salemi and was shot outside the International House of Pancakes on Route 1, Saugus. Four gunmen in camouflage fatigues opened fire on Salemi outside the restaurant, hitting him in the chest and the leg. He survived and put the word out that he wanted to know who ambushed him. One name came from the Carosa's faction kept coming up, Pico Ponzo. The tit-for-tat killing escalated from there. In the months before Mikey's murder, the two sides had agreed to sit down with Romano, negotiating for Carosa's side. Luisi and Stephen Rossetti represented Salemi, according to the court documents. They agreed to slow the bloodshed, but something in Romano's gut told him Salemi wouldn't honor the deal. He was right, and now his son was dead. I thought we were going to leave the kids out of this, Romano shouted at Luisi over the phone. Luisi later testified that he understood in the mob business, children were supposed to be off limits. Bury your son, and when you're done with all that, then call me. I'll come meet you, Luisi said, according to his court testimony. Romano never called. He already had other plans. There was no talking, Romano said. I knew what was coming next. I just had to bury my son first. In early September, the family held a wake at Rapino Memorial Home on Chelsea Street in Maverick Square. The place was a fixture in the cycle of Italian-American life and death in Eastie. Inside Rapino's a mahogany casket draped with a canopy of white and red roses bore a message that read, "Son, I'll cry every day." Inside it, Mikey wore the suit he got married in. A swell of mourners waited to pay their respects in a line that stretched down Chelsea Street all the way to Center Pino's Pizza, where Boston Poles stood alongside made men. Mikey's former high school teammates from Wakefield and East Boston High showed up in hockey jerseys. Every inch of the funeral home was packed with people and flowers. Romano had to extend the wake to 3 days. In the middle of it, Romano stood there in a state of shock, able to do little more than greet people. At some point, an EMT from Everett showed up and handed Romano a gold chain he had taken from Mikey's body in the ambulance so he could return it personally. Romano put it around his neck and has never taken it off. Outside the funeral home, uniformed police cops, Boston cops, and state troopers watched for trouble. The FBI was there, too, photographing license plates and filming the guests. When the wake ended, Romano and his closest allies met near the casket. Romano opened it and turned to men assembled around it. "We're going against some bad guys. We could get killed. We can go to jail or get away with it." Romano remembered telling them, "Whoever wants to leave, you go. You got grace. I understand." Not one of them stepped away. As they lowered the lid of the casket, each one put a hand on the glossy wood. Romano spoke to his son. "Mikey, we bury you tonight, then we bury everyone that put you here. Everyone had a hand in it. The crew had agreed to meet at midnight after the burial in the war room, their nickname for their social club they frequented. Romana had already stocked up cameras, phone bugs, and GPS trackers to put on the target's cars. Later that night, Romano got dressed in black sweatsuit with a black cap. He packed his diabetes medicine to bring with him. Darlene packed him a bag of fruit, reminded him to eat so his sugar doesn't drop. Then he was on his way to Eastie, speeding through the Callahan Tunnel. Once they were all together inside the club, Romano laid out his plan. Let's make a list. Let's put it on the wall. Everyone we think could have been involved. Like detectives, they generated names and started talking to people around Eastie, tracking alibis and eliminating anyone who didn't belong. The crew hatched a plan to take out Salemi. Not only did Romano ultimately blame him for his son's death, but according to court documents, the court wanted to eliminate him so they could take control of the patriarchy family. But there were others who were on the list too, men who weren't in the van that day, yet may have set it all in motion. One of them was Joseph Cerami, who ran the Stadium Cafe and was the man Mikey and the others had gone to see that night. The night Mikey was killed. Romana crew believed Cerami and may have tipped off Salemi's men that Ponzo would be there, putting Mikey in the line of fire. As the crew drove around town looking for their targets, Romano played Sun, The Art of War on his cassette player. The first attempt on Cerami failed. On September 16th, Cerami was shot several times but managed to survive. Then October 13th, according to court documents, they struck him again in a failed attempt to kill Steve Rossetti outside his home. 1 week later, Souza was waiting for Steve Rossetti to pick him up from Benningham Street in Eastie when he noticed activity around the Carosa Social Club. He walked to a payphone, dropped coins in the slot, and called Luisa to say he wanted to go over to the club. In court documents, Luisa later recalled he told him, "Don't go down there, Joe. Just leave it alone," Luisa said. "We'll be out tonight, and we'll go see what's going on." The next time Luisa's phone rang, according to his testimony, it was Steve Rossetti, who had arrived to pick up Sousa and couldn't find him. Rossetti called Luisa, saying there were cops in an ambulance all over Benningham Street. "I think they got Joe," Luisa said. Rossetti told him he was right. Souza, who had walked down into enemy territory armed with a handgun, was shot dead in the phone booth next to the Barney's Cafe. The crew had gotten one of the men they wanted. They were determined to get the rest. But law enforcement had plans of their own. Michael Romano had just gotten home after a late night at Foxwoods when the phone rang at his Wakefield home in the small hours of October 5th, 1995. Darlene was asleep. So were the three girls. The voice on the other end was FBI agent with an organized crime strike force. "Take a look out of your window," Romano remembers the agent telling him. Romano pulled back his bedroom curtain to see a cavalry of vehicles, unmarked federal cars, state police, and Wakefield cruisers. "We have a warrant for your arrest," Romano recalls the agent saying. "We know you have small kids in the house. Come down and open the door." Romano was not surprised to see him. He figured it was only a matter of time. What did surprise him is that they were arriving, says he was arriving in cuffs to the police station, seeing a group of Colombians detained there too. This pinch was nothing to do with the La Rosa Nostra. The feds had picked him up on a money laundering charges connected to a cartel that had been supplying the various factions of Boston's underworld with drugs. Whatsoever those charges were for, Romano didn't see the outside of a prison cell for more than two decades. A year and a half later, in April 1997, while serving time for the drug case, Romano was indicted again. This time it had everything to do with the mob war. Organized crime probably isn't as organized as it was 15 or 20 years ago. U.S. Attorney Donald Stern quipped to the press, announcing that a 40-count indictment against 15 Boston area wise guys connected to the Patriarca family, all Carrozza's loyalists. Among them were men Romano dubbed as the Boston Nine, who had pledged their support in Romano's quest to avenge his son's murder. They were all hit with federal racketeering charges for conspiring to kill more than a dozen members of the rival faction, attempting to kill Salami, Mark Rossetti, Stephen Rossetti, and Cerami, and for the murder of Sousa, among the other related charges. The bad news kept coming for in July. Federal prosecutors told the court they would seek the death penalty against Romano. "It was the emptiness and the loneliest time in my life," Romano recalls, in a ride back to lockup after learning the government wanted him dead. He told Darlene the truth, but asked her not to tell his parents or the children. They found out anyway from the papers, the Evening News, and he says, "America's most wanted. I had no words," he says. "Just worried for my family, how it would destroy them even more." His attorneys, Peter Entenberg and Jay Carney, fought the death penalty before a three-judge panel in Washington and prevailed. The death sentence was off the table. In November 1999, Romano pleaded guilty to the federal courts, including murder conspiracy in aid of racketeering and other related charges. By then, a lot had happened in the outside. The FBI use of mobsters, including Bulger as an informant, had made front-page headlines. Romano watched it all unfold from behind bars. On his cell wall, he began building a chart, not only of the mob, but of the FBI agents he believed were dirty. On the day of his sentences in February 2000, he stood before the judge cradling a frame of Mikey. "Who allowed all this to happen?" Romano asked. "The FBI and the Justice Department. I ask you, where was the FBI agents and the prosecutions and the Justice Department employees and the Boston and State Police when all these people were being murdered? Let me tell you, the corrupt XX, and I reiterate, ex-FBI agents and the others still to be named are keeping it all in the dark by protecting the likes of Frank Salami and his partner Stephen Flemmy and Bulger, allowing them to operate, resulting in the murder of many, many more people, one being my dear son." The judge was unmoved. He sentenced Romano to 252 months, 21 years, for trying to avenge a murder he believed the government had helped make possible. 3 years passed. A series of congressional hearings were held on Capitol Hill regarding the FBI and unholy alliances with the killers. Then in 2004, a report from the House Committee on Government Reform concluded that the FBI's Boston field office had been a partner in crime with the Winter Hill Gang from 1995 to 1990, enabling numerous murderers. Romano read about it from his cell. In the years since his sentencing, he had spent countless hours studying RICO case law, fighting what he calls all the lies, but nothing prepared him for what came next. How can it be a mob war if one side went to prison and all the other side were rats, Romano asked. What Romano didn't know was that some of the rats were still being protected, even then. It took more than a decade after his sentencing for him to learn that the man who had come to believe gave the order to kill Rico Ponzo, which led to the murder of his son, was himself a longtime FBI informant. While bullets flew between both sides of Warren Patriarca fractions, Mark Rossetti, among the men Romano and his Boston Nine had been convicted of trying to kill, was working with the feds. And Rossetti was hardly an ideal candidate for the arrangements. Mark Rossetti, Luisi would later testify, was a heroin junkie. Through this whole war and everything that me and Stephen were doing, Mark was in and out of prison all the time, drug violations, different things. That may be why the FBI hid his longtime alliance with him, even from fellow law enforcement officers. State troopers found out about the arrangements by accident. In the spring of 2010, the court approved wiretaps up all over the city trying to stem the flow of heroin and prevalence of illegal gambling, much of it on the hands of Mark Rossetti. During the investigation, they caught Rossetti on more than 40 phone calls with a man the troopers soon recognized as an FBI agent. That FBI agent turned out to be his handler, and in August 2011, Rossetti was ousted as another longtime FBI snitch. Romano was still in prison when the news first broke in a WCVB investigation by this writer. "I realized why they took me off the street," Romano recalls, explaining that he believed the FBI didn't want him to take Rossetti out because they wanted to maintain him as their informant inside the Patriarca family. "I feel sick to my stomach." 5 years after the Rossetti revelation in 2016, Romano was released from prison. He'd done 21 years. On the outside, he had made an agreement with the powers that be at the helm of the New England mob. "No more killing. Leave it alone," he says that he asked him. Romano agreed. "I accept the fact that it was an accident. They were trying to kill Ricky Ponzo, and they killed the wrong guy, my son." He had to start all over. He and Darlene had divorced, and he couldn't go back to the house he walked out of to be arrested 21 before. He found an apartment on the beach in Revere, got a union job, and started a civil engineering firm, which did quite well. Then on a trip to Chicago, he saw a mob tour and thought he could do something similar in Boston. Who knew the mob and what happened better than I, he says. He joined forces with a friend who had a limo business and now gives the tours year-round, driving clients through Southie, the North End, and downtown Boston, past the old clubhouses, the crime scenes, and the places where bodies dropped. Romano had tried justice by violence. It cost him 21 years. Now he tried the courts. "I served my time like a man, and I didn't rat on anyone, and I came home, and I sued the government," Romano said in the lawsuit his family, representing Mikey's estate, filed against the feds for protecting men like Rossetti who were implicated in murders. He later agreed to give up the pursuit to prevent his daughters, who all hold prominent jobs and now live far from the blood-stained streets of East Boston, from being drawn back into family backstory of mob involvement. These days, Romano spends his time with his slain son's two children, his daughters, his 13 grandchildren, and now he sits at the helm of the New England chapter of Italian American Civil Rights League, an organization started in New York City in 1970 by Colombo crime family boss Joseph Colombo to fight what he saw as a wrongful discrimination against Italian Americans. The group's Unity Day rallies once drew tens of thousands and famously forced the producers of The Godfather to strike the word mafia and Casa Nostra from the script. Romano has honored with organization's Man of the Year Award in December. Closer to home, the Christopher Columbus statue in the North End was vandalized and put into storage by city officials. Romano and others pushed to have it moved to a private location where the community keeps watch. "He's protected by the neighborhood now," Romano said. Many of the 14 people indicted alongside Romano served decades behind bars. Rizzo Ponzo, though, spent 16 years on the run, posing as an Idaho rancher named Jay Shaw, until he was arrested in February 2011 while buying hay for his black Angus cows. In 2014, he was found guilty of the 1989 attempted murder of Salimi and the 1994 attempted murder of Cerami, among other charges, and sentences to 28 years in prison. He didn't make it that long. Ponzo died in prison on New Year's Eve in 2019, respiratory failure, according to court records. Romano says he heard Ponzo was poisoned. 2 decades after Romano's quest for revenge was cut short, and when he was arrested, there are some mobsters who still had punishment for Mikey's... Okay. 2 decades after Romano's quest for revenge was cut short when he was arrested, there were some mobsters who still had punishment for Mickey's death on their minds. On the evening of October 29, 2018, Whitey Bulger found himself inside a Hazleton Federal Penitentiary in West Virginia. The 89-year-old was confined to a wheelchair when the Federal Bureau of Prisons abruptly transferred him where a cable of Boston gangsters were waiting. Among them was Paul J. DeColorongo, DeColoGero, a nephew of one of the Romano's Boston Nine loyalists. Reports of the incident describe how three men were set upon Bulger, lunging him with a padlock wrapped in a sock and attempted to gouge out his eyes. According to Romano, as Bulger was dying, DeGolongo, who convicted of assault for serving as lookout during the attack, spoke some of the last words the age monster would have heard. "This is for little Mikey. Have a trip to hell. Your friends are waiting for you, you cocksucker." Meanwhile, the murder of Michael Romano Jr. remains a cold case in Middlesex County. No one has ever been charged. On Father's Day, Romano does what he has done every Father's Day since he got out of prison. He visits Mikey's grave, which lies right next to a plot Romano bought so he can one day be buried alongside his son. "I talk to him. He says, I say, rest in peace, Mikey. They're all in hell." I'm now reading from the Globe magazine, the June 7th edition from the Boston Globe. "Interrupt Me, Please" by Benjamin Nymphy. In May of 2008, my then-girlfriend called and asked if she could bring Buffy, her new Yorkie poodle puppy, over to my dingy off-campus apartment. I had already been in sort of limbo wanting to break up with her. She was kind and pretty and brilliant. I was an English major in a Michigan State University whose best job prospect was coaching springboard diving, a sport dying a slow, underfunded death. I wanted to preempt the inevitability of her breaking up with me, and this puppy, sort of purse dog, had grown disciplined toward for reasons not unrelented, to Paris Hilton's Chihuahua in The Simple Life, gave me an easy out. I said yes, hung up the phone, and calculated that I had 12 minutes until she arrived to figure out how I was going to break the news. 11 minutes later, I opened the door and found my girlfriend there, all smiles, clutching a 3-pound ball of silky black fur, and its docked tail wagging so fast it looked as if the small creature might take flight. I let her in, promptly forgot everything I had planned to say, and fell in love. 17 and a half years later, a marriage, 2 houses, 2 cross-country moves, and 2 beautifully, wildly different daughters followed that afternoon in 2008, and the excitable little ball of energy was part of it until last fall, when we said our sobbing final goodbyes to Buffy. I used to complain about Buffy's neediness, her constant barking at every passerby or pawing at my leg, until I tried in vain to work in my basement office. Near the end, I complained about cleaning up her accidents, about endless vet appointments, but I assumed Buffy would always be there, and it's only now, in the brutal silence she left behind, that I realize how much I miss caring for her. There's nothing I could say about the time has locomotion towards the certain end we all face that hasn't been said before. Life is too short. It goes fast. We all know it. We don't simultaneously. 17 and a half years we had Buffy, a miraculously long life for a dog, but barely a footnote in the universe sense. A flash of time that mirrors how long I'll have my daughters before they're grown and out of the house. My girls are 4 and 6 now, ages that made them just independent enough to get into trouble, but not self-sufficient enough to refill their own snack cups with goldfish crackers or blueberries. Even when my mother babysits, impossible to work while they tear through the upstairs with their little feet thudding and thunking on the floor above my office. their shrieks as they fight over Duplo blocks and Elsa dolls. Once a productive workday has been truncated to a handful of distracted hours. But I know now that Buffy's 17-year life has come and gone in an instant, that today's mountains will be tomorrow's molehills. I know that in the not-too-distant future, I wish there were little thunk-thunks on the floor above me the way I wish Buffy would come and paw at my legs until I picked her up. I know I will one day, as I'm lying in my bed in my quiet, empty house, wish that I had a little voice would whine, "Daddy!" and that I will have the chance to be a hero simply by snuggling, the same way I could pick up Buffy when she was barking and scratching her ears, and all would be right in the world. Soon my girls will be grown, off to college, jobs, families of their own. My house will be empty, and I'll be able to focus on my work, but I won't want to. I'll just want someone to need me. A four-letter word starting with L. Written by Kara Ching. When I was younger, I asked my parents if they loved me. "No need to say it," was the response, but it wasn't the same saying it, I protested, but it didn't matter. Nothing changed. When I was 5 years old, I watched the other kids in my class get kisses goodbye from their mommies, so I asked my mother to give me a kiss, too. "I'm sick," she told me in the car. I didn't ask after that. 7 years ago, my father took a look around the dorm that would be my temporary home during my 3-week summer camp. Everything put in order, he turned to me, arms outstretched, and he gave me a big hug. It probably looked like a hug between two robots. He never hugged me before, and he's never done it again. I didn't examine these moments closely until a friend of mine told me about all the Christmas gifts she bought her parents. I'd never given my parents anything other than an odd gift of a glass-blown fish my mom had shaken her head at and deemed too expensive. I used to chalk it up to the family being weird. It was weird. And I could hardly write my brother a graduation note because of saying on paper I was proud of him was deeply painful and uncomfortable. Odd that my parents didn't celebrate their anniversary, never went on dates or even held hands. Definitely bizarre when I heard parents telling their kids and the kids telling their parents they loved each other in phone calls. And what mere thought of saying anything close to that made my throat close up. We just didn't feel that way, not like the white families surrounding us in Kansas. It hurt sometimes knowing whenever we asked anything I could see, whenever we had wasn't anything I could see around us. I told my mom about these thoughts recently. She predictably laughed. "What would you have wanted then? Would you have wanted for us to be like all those people?" The parents of one of my friends often posted on social media about my friend's every achievement with glowing pride and praise. Every time my friend left home after a break, there would be an ardent Facebook post about half their parents' hearts going away again. My mom doesn't have social media, and my dad hasn't touched his Facebook page in years. After I chose Boston University, my parents didn't say much. Even privately, my father said, "Okay," and started looking for plane tickets. Maybe it was the only way he could say, "I'm proud of you." My mom and dad helped me move halfway across the country. They planned and saved for decades for me to get there, the same as their parents did for them, no different from what they've been doing for my siblings. Their quiet, clear acceptance might have been a greater gift than anything I could have held in my hands. My mother sent me pictures of clothes and appliances she thinks are a good deal. Then I go home. I see the clothes she bought for me, folded in tags, still on. Maybe that's the same as a hug or a kiss on the cheek. I see glimpses of something like love and affection at all times. I see in my mom's reminders to put my money in my retirement funds, in a blender and a kitchen knives she bought. When I moved into my first apartment, I see in every home-cooked meal my dad put on the table, every car ride he gave, every bowl of fruit he washed and prepared for me and my siblings over the past 20 years. If there is a word that can hold all of that in its letters, I haven't found it yet. My parents have never told me they loved me. I think I'd like to keep it that way. That's all the time we have today. My name is Janet. Thank you for listening to the Talk and Information Center.